This podcast is brought to you by Sky Arts, proud broadcast sponsor of the Guardian Hay Festival, bringing you the book show at Hay every day at 7 p.m. on Sky Arts One HD with me, Mariella Frostrup. For details, visit sky.com/arts.
You're listening to the Guardian Haycast, and I'm Robert Winston, and I'm just a tiny bit scared because now I'm meeting the questions from the Guardian readership, which is a great deal more intimidating than the Guardian journalists, who one can easily deal with. So let's hear your questions.
In his book, Bad Ideas, he talks about innovations making us more vulnerable. So looking around here at the Hay Festival, is there anything that he can see that he thinks is making us more vulnerable?
Yes, writing. Books are the most dangerous and subversive way of communicating, only more recently beaten by the internet. Pretty well every civilization, even democratic ones, have attempted to restrict, censor, and refine books that they didn't approve of. Fortunately, we live in a society where we don't censor newspapers, where we don't censor books, and where we actually can't regulate the internet. But in my view, the power of the internet hasn't really started to show itself, and it'll be interesting when it does.
One person I'd love to meet would be Robert Winston. I know he's a very religious man. How does he square his scientific views with his religious views?
I don't really think there's a conflict between religion and science, and it always troubles me that there's a very polarised view. To my mind, essentially, both religion and science are expression of our uncertainty. Religion, because we don't know where we're going to, we don't know where we've come from. Science, because to some extent we don't know where we've come from and we don't know where we're going to. And I think that that uncertainty is very healthy but very difficult to deal with. And perhaps it's worth saying that I think religion is at its most dangerous when it's absolutely certain. And I think that's true of science as well. I think certainty in science is highly dangerous. All right, now, I'm afraid time's running out. I've got to run, so just the last few questions very quickly.
Robert Winston, what is your guiltiest pleasure?
I'm not going to tell you what my guiltiest pleasure is. Some of them are extremely private, some of them less so. I quite like malt whiskey, and I think I drink too much alcohol.
Robert Winston, could you please tell me what trait you most admire in others and what trait you most dislike about yourself?
I think I most admire integrity and honesty in other people, a notion that what you see is what you get. To some extent, I haven't really lived up to those expectations in myself, and I think that that's something which I deprecate.
If I was to meet Robert Winston, I'd like to know, you seem to have been on our televisions and around for a long time. Do you plan to carry on, or do you have any retirement plans? What are your plans for the future?
The first time I was on television was in 1967, when my trousers came down doing a caesarean section. It was the first live caesarean section on television. I don't have plans to retire. I've got something on tonight, and I've got another programme in the pipeline. I would like to think that I could carry on, but one recognises that one can meet one's sell-by date, and that may be something that I have done. I don't know whether, in fact, people still want to watch the stuff I do. I think when they don't, I'll stop. Right, that's all. It's 11:30 in the morning. I've got another gig, so I'm going to have to run now. So thank you very much.
And remember, you can post your questions to our Haycast interviewees on the blog. Over the weekend, we'll be talking to Roy Hattersley, Charlie Higson, Sue Townsend and David Remnick. And today, Claire and I have come to the garden of the Green Room to record our Haycast. And this is the room on the site that the festival director, Peter Florence, has set up as a sort of sanctuary to all the writers and performers who are appearing. We're not really supposed to do interviews in here, but we snuck in the back.
Well, there are actually a series of sanctums within sanctums. I do remember one case where the grassy bit that we're sitting in is the most generalised one. You could probably hear the sound of children in the background. Then there's a sort of generalised internal space, but there is a sort of very private little inner sanctum in which a couple of years ago I remember seeing Sherry Blair's rather elegantly trousered legs protruding. And about 6 inches away from her, but on the other side of the flap, were William and Fionn Haig, and their eyes did not not meet over a crowded flap. More recently, today, I was sitting there with the psychologist, Terry Apter, who's talking about sisters, and Jacqueline Wilson. And poor old Terry Apter was bemoaning the fact that they'd gone head-to-head, since all the sisters in Hay would be rushing to Jacqueline Wilson. She wondered how many would be left to come and hear her.
You hosted that event, Claire, and I came along to it and did a sort of head count as I was going out, and I think there were about 150 people there, and maybe 8 of them were men. So I guess you might have had a couple of sisters.
But there was a very good question from a man, actually.
There was a really good question from a man.
So brothers can be equally rivalrous.
Yeah.
She did acknowledge that. And our Hay diarists, of course, have been busy at work picking up overheard snatches of conversation. I particularly liked one involving Anthony Beaver and A.C. Grayling, in which Anthony Beaver started by boasting that he was doing 4 events, to which A.C. Grayling replied, "Well, I'm doing 6. But of course, they were both bested by Sharma, the indefatigable Simon Sharma.
Who said, apparently, that he's a book festival tart.
And that came from his own mouth, so we're quite clear of the libel laws of this country. Another amusing moment was in the former Foreign Secretary Douglas Hurd's session, when a member of the audience posed a pressing question about European diplomacy.
What ways and means are there, covert or otherwise, of repairing our relationship with the Eurovision Song Contest?
And that's obviously another example of the audiences at Hay having far the best questions. Other weird and wonderful events this week have included an event on social dreaming that our writer Alison Flood went to, and she's blogged about it on the site, and you can go and read about it there. And everyone, I think, is putting their own dreams in the comments.
Can you just tell me what social dreaming is?
Well, okay, I'll try. What it basically involves is, rather than having your dreams and thinking about them and then forgetting about them or going to tell Freud or whomever, you sit down together and you share what you've been dreaming about. And apparently it's an incredibly cathartic experience. You get all of the tension and whatever's going on in your head kind of comes out through this method. And it has been very successful in the past, apparently, in doing things like conflict resolution, preventing the incidents of wars. And one of the weird knock-on effects is that we've instituted a social dreaming session over breakfast every morning at our Guardian House. And some strange revelations there have been from that as well.
Well, my daughter actually told me today that she dreamt of the apocalypse this morning, so I wonder what that means.
Nothing until the end of the week, I hope.
Motorway, motorway, where have you been? Motorway, where are you stopping? I've been down to London to pick up the Queen to take her up north to go shopping. I'm Simon Armitage, and the last book that made me cry, actually it's not a new book, it's probably one of our very earliest books, was The Odyssey, which I've been rereading over and over recently for various projects. And there's a section where Odysseus goes down to the underworld and meets amongst many dead friends and acquaintances there his mother. She suddenly appears out of the darkness. He doesn't even know she's dead, and he encounters her apparition, and he tries to hug her 3 times, and she just vaporizes on each occasion. And he at first he's sort of furious, and he says, you know, what foul play brought about this murder? And she says, I wasn't murdered. I died of longing for you, my son. I died of a broken heart. I mean, for such a, you know, for one of the first ever poems, such a kind of literary genius is utterly bewildering.
I'm Charlotte Higgins, and I'm here with 2 of Cambridge University's finest ancient historians, Paul Cartledge and Richard Miles. They both work in the same department at Cambridge, but they're rather at the opposite end of the spectrum. Richard has just written a book about ancient Carthage, and Paul works largely on classical Greece, especially Sparta. Ancient history seems to be flowering at the moment. Lots of sword and sandals films, lots of popular books being written on the subject. Why do you think ancient history is having a moment in the sun? Why is it worth studying, Richard?
Why is it having a moment in the sun? I think ancient history has been having its moment in the sun for a long time, and for a number of different reasons. Firstly, because, of course, we identify with it in the modern world, with the ancient world so much, with Greece and Rome, and perhaps even Carthage. That's the first reason. I think the other thing is that it's glamorous at some level. I think that people find a sort of glamour in the ancient world. I think what ancient historians have become very good at is that sort of that big question we should always ask ourselves, which is, so what? Why is this important? Because, you know, the past can be as dull as the present. if not duller.
Yeah, I'd like to take up what Richard was saying, that what one's got to do on the one hand is see continuities, for example, politics. We all think politics is important. The Greeks invented it, the Romans developed it. Many, many cultures have never had what you and I would call politics. So there's a very important continuity. On the other hand, the way they did politics, what they understand by democracy, is utterly different from what you and I think of as being democracy today. So to me, it's the interface, or rather the clash between ancient and modern, that is the interesting point about it.
Teaching of history has been a big topic at Hay this year. Neil Ferguson was here talking about how he thought that secondary school pupils ought to be taught the great sweep of history from 1500 to the beginning of the 20th century, and history should be compulsory up to GCSE. And someone said, what about ancient history? And he said, well, they're much simpler societies to understand. So let's do that in primary school. We'll do Mesopotamia until the height of the Roman Empire for sort of 5 to 11-year-olds. What do you think about that idea, Paul?
It's a point of view, and Ferguson is a man of strong views, which he holds strongly and expresses strongly. But of course, it's all also, as one of Mrs. Thatcher's advisors was fond of saying, bunkum and balderdash, because the ancient world is immensely sophisticated and complex. And let's just give you one example: Christianity, which of course comes in many, many varieties. There's no such thing as Christianity. There's this sort, that sort. Well, that emerged into the ancient, the Greek bit of the Roman Empire, could not have emerged anywhere else in the form it did. The New Testament is in Greek, etc., etc. But before then, there were thousands of gods. Now, I defy Neil Ferguson to comprehend even one of them, let alone thousands of them. Try getting your head round that, trying to enter the mental universe of a very alien people. I defy him to find that simple.
I think what my colleague's trying to say, and I'll say it in a slightly more direct way, that you could only think that the ancient world was simple if you knew bugger all about it.
Now, Richard, you're talking about Carthage, which is the subject of your latest book. So we sort of know Carthage as the big Mediterranean power that Rome had to defeat in order to become top nation. Why did Rome win, and why is Carthage interesting?
Oh, just a small question there. Thanks very much. Rome probably won more than anything because, in the end, it played by a slightly different set of rules. And I'll give you one good example. So the great story of Hannibal having the sort of road to Rome open to him. So he wins this huge victory in 216. There's virtually no Roman army left. It looks like it's absolutely free for him to march on Rome. And he doesn't do it. And everyone says, oh, it's because you know how to win a battle, but you don't know how to finish anyone off. You don't know how to win a war. Well, actually, it's because Hannibal was just sort of conforming to the rules of warfare in the Hellenistic period, which is you got people into the sort of death grip, but you didn't finish them off. You got them to a position of weakness, and then everything's up for grabs, because all territory is basically spear won, and actually you can trade a bit of horse trading, you can trade this for that. One of the problems is that what Rome did with territory it conquered is it turned it into Roman territory, and it became quickly as Roman as the centre of Rome. And this meant that there was no kind of reverse gear. The reason why Carthage is important, okay, the stereotype, and of course with all stereotypes there is something to it, is the idea of the economic superpower, you know, shifting cargoes across the Mediterranean, etc., etc. Trade is the engine of civilization, the engine of culture. You know, when people are trading, what they take with them is they don't just take goods, they don't just take people, they take ideas with them too. And that's a less glamorous and a less visible thing than inventing philosophy or great works of art, etc. So in other words, it's less tangible to us, but it's equally important.
Right, Richard, I want you to tell me one thing I didn't know about Carthage, and Paul, I want you to tell me one thing I didn't know about Sparta.
Carthaginians had a god called Sid.
Excellent.
Is that hissing, Sid? Sorry. But you want to tell me something you don't know about Sparta. Well, if a Spartan went to Athens and he saw someone sitting down on a sit-down toilet, he was absolutely appalled. And the reason for that was that if an older man comes into the same space as a younger man, the young man is sitting down, he must leap up to give his seat to the older man. And the Spartan would say, and this is a historically documented joke, and we're not far away from from certain facilities in Hay at this precise moment. I would never wish to be in a city where I couldn't get up to give my seat up to an older man.
Just for you to bring it all down to the gutter, Paul. I can't believe it.
My name is Ian McEwan, and the last book I read was The Postman Always Rings Twice. It's a wonderful novella. 112 pages long, a whole world evoked, a folly that accelerates, a murder that goes hugely wrong. It's a beautiful piece. I recommend it to everyone.
I'm standing outside Hay Cinema Bookshop with Rick Jakowski, the rare books dealer whose book Tolkien's Gown and Other Stories of Great Authors and Rare Books told of his adventures in the book trade, and whose new book, Outside of a Dog, reflects on his life through the medium of the books that have populated it. Rick, how long have you been coming to Hay for?
I've been coming here since the late 60s, when I found it enormously exciting. There were a lot of unsifted books and there were bargains to be had. Hay was first colonised in 1962 by one Richard Booth, who had the brilliant idea of buying books in gigantic numbers and taking over a town and filling it up with books. And, of course, nobody else, if you said to them, do you want 100,000 books from a defunct library, would buy them. So it was a brilliant marketing idea. And as I kept coming over the years, all the bargains went away, more books stopped coming in, and my impression over the last few years has been Hay is the kind of terminal moraine of the book chain. But I'm a little bit worried that I won't find anything that sets the adrenaline flowing as a rare book dealer.
So you've had some thoughts about the shops that it's worth going to have a look into, and we're going to start by going into the Hay Cinema Bookshop.
Cinema Bookshop I first came to in like 1968, and it will bring back a lot of memories. I used to come here and I used to think that it was gigantic. It seems either I've got bigger or it's shrunk. But on the other hand, Francis Edwards, the venerable old dealers, are here, and it might be they'd have something for me.
So let's see, what are we looking at here?
It's The Ballad of Reading Gaol by Oscar Wilde. And interestingly enough, it's inscribed from Frank Harris, who wrote the preface to Alfred Rose. Frank Harris, I'm sure you know, is a bit of an old degenerate.
My Life and Love's in four volumes. The only writer ever to make sex dull. Let me have a look at that. I've always been interested in Oscar Wilde, and I have an absolutely marvellous Oscar Wilde client who lives in Istanbul and is Turkish and is very, very sophisticated and always looking for interesting things. So what's really interesting, it's given to Alfred Rose from Frank Harris in May of 1918, and in July of 1918, Alfred Rose gives it to Fiona Cully because he doesn't like it at all. Well, that's rather fun, I think.
So is that one of the interesting things about dealing in books, then, looking at what people have written in them, tracing
what
the stories?
What I adore about books is I don't care about first editions and dust wrappers and all that. I like books that generate narratives, and this book would appear to have an interesting narrative attached to it. I don't know if my Turkish client would want this, and I'm not sure if it fits into stock, but tell me what the bottom line is.
£360.
So £360 is bookseller's standard 20% discount, and at that price I will cogitate, but I'm not uninterested.
Okay, brilliant. So where are we off to next?
I think we're off to Addyman's. Is that what it's called?
Addyman's.
Addyman's. All right, we're off to Addyman's.
So we're standing now outside Addyman's bookshop, the Addyman Annex, it's called. Beautiful window display of largely, I think, new books.
Oh no, I can already see things looking in.
Okay, we better
start.
Hold on,
I want to
move
go
inside.
In, please.
Hello. Hi, I'm Rick Jakowski.
Hi, I'm Anne. I'm one of the owners of this bookshop.
Anne, how
I'm
are
Sarah.
You?
No, okay. This is Tom Wolfe.
What I live for is locked cases with nice things in them. And looking at this nice case, it actually has more things in it than I had even hoped for. Let's have a look.
Which case would you like open first?
Let's look at the William Goldings.
Okay. Yes, we are very lucky to buy this collection from a unique lady. And she wrote wonderful letters to her favourite writers. And she got wonderful letters in return. Here is a first edition of Lord of the Flies, along with a presentation copy and a bunch load of letters. The letters are phenomenal.
they tell her why he wrote things, what he feels about things. No, he will not drop it off because it's too valuable. No, he doesn't want to be responsible for her first edition. And if she wants it signed, she's going to have to come here and things like that. He is fun.
Actually, he wasn't that much fun. He was grumpy as could be, and he hated signing books.
Well,
he signed a lot of things for me once, and he hated every single one. And finally, I could only get him to sign if I gave him a fiver for every signature. Yeah. Let me have a look at that. Yeah. Now, all right, first editions of Lord of the Flies, as we know, are worth £3,000 to £5,000, depending on condition. This is rather a nice one. They're not, in general, inscribed. There aren't many inscribed ones. And this has a nice inscription which isn't dated, so in spite of the fact that it's probably a bit later, we can't tell that. And it's priced with some letters which seem to have rather good content at £12,500.
10,000 to you.
10,000 to me and going downwards. tell me where your price comes from.
We looked it up. We worked out it's also going to be a centenary next year. And in fact, people say, yeah, first editions go for £3,000 to £5,000, but when you look at them, there's usually some fault on them. As you say, they're usually not signed. In the end, I imagine we'll sell this for between £8,000 and £10,000. Yeah. But we have put this on at a very special price because it is a very special book and very unique.
It's what I always call slightly prophylactic price, is it? Wards off customers.
We have a number of really irritating modern first dealers in the area who sort of want to haggle and want to say our price is all wrong. But modern first dealers are often the most difficult people in the bookselling world. But Rick has been surprisingly pleasant.
I think you're on the nail with the price.
That's very good to hear.
The question is there a margin for me? Because as a dealer, if I'm going to sell a book at 8.5, I want to buy it at 5 at the most.
Exactly.
So you're right, and therefore there's no room for me to interpose my body between anybody, much as I would like to.
Well,
it's a very good book,
it.
And it's an absolutely lovely shop.
We're walking through the lovely streets of Hay-on-Wye. Quite quiet, actually, as we're in the middle of the week. Where are we off to now, Rick?
We're off to what is, it says outside, is called Richard Booth, which has apparently now been bought by an American new owner and retitled The Limited Bookshop, only it still says Richard Booth outside. But they've done it up rather beautifully, and it's actually a very, very nice bookshop. So I'm rather looking forward to coming in here.
Wow, this has changed since the last time I was there.
The last time I came in here was probably 3 or 4 years ago, and it was really tumble down. It's crammed to the rafters with books, but dusty, cobwebs, everything. And now it's incredibly inviting, still crammed to the rafters, but beautiful.
All right, do you have anything? I'm terrible at scouting books, and I just look and I go all blank. So do you have anything you could show me?
I can show you a first edition of The Hobbit.
We've had those over the years. I'd like to see one. This is a very pretty copy of The Hobbit. Dust wrapper is rather beautiful. First edition, of course, is 1937. It has an absolutely ravishing dust wrapper in white, black, blue, and green. And the nice thing about the wrapper is actually designed by Tolkien himself, who could draw. And if you look all along the top and the bottom edge of it, there's kind of runic characters, which actually do say something. And I used to know what they said, but I don't anymore. Now, see, this is not a first edition dust wrapper. This is a later dust wrapper because it has an advertisement for The Lord of the Rings. And Lord of the Rings are published in the 1950s, and The Hobbit is published in the 1930s.
Ah.
So, alas, first edition of this book worth about £12,000 to £15,000.
Well, that one's only 250, I think.
So. That's 250. So it's correctly described and it's correctly priced, but it's just not for me.
Have you thought of a career in the secondhand book business?
We are back in the street again. We've been to three shops. We've got a couple more to go. Is there anything that's really caught your eye so far? Anything you think you'll be spending your money on?
No, my wallet is firmly still in my pocket. But I'm right across the street, and I'd love to go in there, and I'm not going to allow myself to. There's a gorgeous shop called Murder and Mayhem, and it deals in thrillers. And I'm addicted to thrillers, and I have this thing, because I'm chairing the International Man Booker Prize at the moment, I can only read novels for that, because in the next year I have to probably read 400 novels. If I go in the thriller bookshop, I'll buy thrillers. and I'm not allowed to buy thrillers, so I'm not going in.
Right, so let's move on.
So here we are in the poetry bookshop, my favourite bookshop in Hay, I think. I come in here every year. And it's the only bookshop in the whole of the UK that stocks nothing but poetry. So poetry lovers delight. And what is it that you've got your eye on in here?
We're talking W.H. Auden now. And W.H. Auden is not a good market. It's hard to sell Auden. The title of the book, collection of poetry called About the House, and it's published in New York. It's, I think, 1940s, doesn't seem to have a date on it, but it has an inscription on the front that says Chester with love from Whiston. And that is Chester Coleman, who was Whiston's lover and partner for most of his life. And this
Whiston
is,
being a W.H.
Whiston is W.H. Auden. Says, these are public words addressed to you in private in Auden's hand. And apparently, the owner tells me, this showed up at an Oxfam shop. Can we ask about that? I like to know about provenance with good books. Did this really show up at an Oxfam shop?
So we were told, yeah, but in Sydenham, yeah.
But you bought it subsequently?
Yeah, he sold it to us, yeah.
Oh, he sold it to you immediately?
Yeah.
And he knew what it was?
Oh, he knew what it was, yeah. Right. He didn't pay very much for it, obviously.
I would have thought not. And but presumably you did, because once you get down the line, you pay more. Now, what's fabulous about it is it doesn't merely have that inscription, which is wonderful, but it has notes and corrections throughout the text in Auden's hand on 20 or 30 pages. Now, famously, Auden revised his poetry as the poems had further life. So instead of saying this poem was published in 1927, I'm going to leave it alone, Auden kept rewriting it in his head. So here you have something, it's a £5 book or a £10 book, it's nothing. But it's fabulous. It has this most wonderful narrative attached to it. And a price, which is most wonderful price attached to it, of £6,000. The way you value books as a rare book dealer is you say, if this book walked into my shop, at what price would I say no to it? So if this walked into the shop at £2,000, I'd say thank you so much and write a check. At three, I would write a check, but my pen would be hesitating over the checkbook. At four, I think I'd probably be saying no, which is to say, that's how I valued it, right? So at £3,500, if I could buy this book at £3,500, I think I would.
So is this a bid?
Would we take three and a half?
I think we'd prefer four.
And £4,000 would be your bottom line?
I think £4,000 is a good price.
I think £4,000 is a perfectly reasonable price. It's well below what I would ask. I'm going to walk at four, but the offer of three and a half stays on the table. I'm grateful. I shall go home and think about this book a great deal. Yeah. But this is the best book I've seen in Hay. It has real texture and resonance. It's fabulous. It's right out of the factory. It's Keats, isn't it, who says it's snatched from the penetralium of mystery. And that's what I like.
You're not going to be able to sleep.
That was really incredible and amazing to see Auden's pen on the page and his name's dedication. Do you think you'll go back for it or not?
Not at £4,000. I mean, that book has got under my skin, and what I deal in is books that get under my skin. And I like it a lot. But what I'm doing is thinking and thinking and thinking who in my customer base would want it. And I may be missing something. I'll have to talk to my colleague back in the office and see if he can think of something. But that is an extremely good book. It's not inconceivable that they'll come back to me, because this is a hard thing to say, but in a certain way, in food chain terms, I'm a notch up the food chain for that kind of book. And in Hay, there aren't that many collectors who are going to buy it. On the other hand, he quite rightly knows, he's a very smart guy, that A, he has a very, very good book, and B, he hasn't shown it to anybody yet.
Well, if I had £4,000, I'd buy it. But
I'll sell it to you. I'll buy it for £3,800, and you're on.
Let me get back to my bank.
Anyway, clearly, palpably, I'm wrong about Hay on Wye. My view of Hay-on-Wye as the place that books go to die is clearly no longer true. There's a lot of good books here. There are sophisticated book people. There are sophisticated bookshops. There are things that, even at my relatively rarefied end of the market, I want to own. And that is terrific, and I'm delighted to have learned it.